you don't really have a choice. Every major company has a warehouse in LA, Orange County, or the Inland Empire. As far as the challenges, yeah, it's really hard to do business here. But if you can survive and you do well, yeah, the sky's the limit.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lampier, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, the podcast where we interview key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping real estate, and as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we speak with Matthew Rossman from Bryan Industrial Properties about the unique world of California Class B industrial. We also discuss multiple methods for owners to maximize their relationships with tenants and tenant reps to get more out of their assets. Ultimately, we discuss the future of commercial real estate, including trends in hybridization and repurposing of commercial spaces. If you're an industrial owner or an owner's representative, today's podcast is well worth a listen.
Hey, Matt, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me, Gordon.
So why real estate? There's so many different things that you could do.
You know, it's kind of funny. I bounced around a ton in college. I studied engineering. I studied programming. I studied liberal arts and wasn't really sure what to do. And in getting into real estate and doing more industrial deals, it actually helps a ton because it's a little bit of everything. It like, you know, the manufacturing guy, we have to go through the power. We have to understand that. Legal. God knows we have plenty of contracts and everything else to deal with. It keeps you on your toes. And it's a new thing every single day.
We talked about real estate, but why commercial real estate and why industrial real estate in particular? Most people don't think of big boxes or little boxes as particularly interesting. So what got you into the field?
I actually started out in multifamily. My godfather had a multifamily company. This is back in like 06, 07 when it was crazy. And I lasted there for about 3 months. It was the standard, like go into the office, put the headsets on, there's a script on the machine, just read, dial. And that's just not my, I can't do that. So had an opportunity to check out some industrial stuff out in the Inland Empire. And yeah, once I hit the ground running, I just never stopped. And now I can't stop.
What makes the Inland Empire a particularly interesting place to do commercial real estate? Because there's so many people that when they look, they perceive California as this like wasteland dystopia where nobody does any business. And from at least my knowledge of doing business with firms that are in California, that's not really the case. So why the Inland Empire and what's business like doing, or what's it like doing business in California?
Well, everybody does do it here. You kind of have to an extent. And I think that's what drives demand so much. The port of LA and Long Beach, and with the growth of China from 2005 to now, you don't really have a choice. Every major company has a warehouse in LA, Orange County, or the Inland Empire. As far as the challenges, yeah, it's really hard to do business here. But if you can survive and you do well, yeah, the sky's the limit. That, and you know, there's other things that factor in. You know, the Inland Empire, and you can go into like the history of development in California. It was the only place there was land in the last 20 years. So, you know, you go to LA, I don't care what kind of project you're doing, it's a redevelopment deal. There's no flat land. There's no vacant land. Oh, hey, let me go, you know, there's a 3-acre parcel down the way. Let's go put a 20,000 square foot building up on it. That doesn't exist. And as buildings have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, yeah, you have to go where there's land. And previously that was the Inland Empire, but even they're running out of land now.
And so can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think for some of our developers and investors that work in Texas or even some of the southern states like, you know, Atlanta, there's this idea that you can always go one town further out. But in California, that's kind of less the case. How have you seen that play out in your time? And how have your investors kind of seen that play out in their portfolio?
I think the best example I can give of it is working on the tenant side, especially working with a company that's not in California on the tenant side. Because people don't realize the density and the number of people that are here and how that plays out into everything. So years ago, I did a bunch of work with Flowers Foods, and we set up a huge distribution network for them. And you know, originally it was like, oh, well, we want to be within 30 miles of Orange County. Well, that's like all of Southern California. And they thought 30 miles meant 30 minutes. And 30 miles can be like 6 hours. I mean, if you hit the wrong time of traffic going to LAX, yeah, you're going to get killed. So you know, as that played out, you realize that that extra 5 miles here equates to 45 minutes or an hour. And it really focuses people back in to where the density's at, where the port's at, where LA is at, Orange County, and just kind of pushes everybody westward here.
And I'm guessing in particular that plays out in industrial in last mile, because for some cities and some metro areas, transit is a little easier. So that last mile is pretty quick, and some that last mile might be a little longer. So how have you seen that play out in the industrial space in California in terms of people looking at getting to those last mile developments, particularly when land is so tight?
Last mile here has been a lot of either reuse. Wasn't too far down the street here in Anaheim, Amazon repurposed an old Fry's electronics store into a last mile fulfillment center. So you see a lot of that. You know, the other thing with restrictions on building and entitlements and things along those lines kind of playing into that, we see this weird trend where something arrives at the port, ships out to a warehouse, then ships out to a fulfillment center. But I think most of our stuff's getting filled directly from the warehouses.
When we're talking about these major sites, you got Port of LA, Orange County, Inland Empire. Can you kind of explain the land, lay of the land for us?
Yeah, I think it all goes to history. Like, you know, development in California started in LA. I mean, that's really where you, and this is going back into like the 50s, right? And as they filled out the land more and more, obviously you push, just like everywhere else does, you start pushing east, 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 east. And, you know, you get back into like the 50s, 60s, 70s, and you had this big push into Orange County. Bryan Industrial, we started in 55. You know, I have aerials of when we started construction. Heck, I have the original land contract where our office is. We had to structure the land deal around almond harvest season because it was an almond farm and they wanted to get the last harvest in before we built, I don't know, 400,000 square feet of industrial buildings here. And with that, and you look at what was going on in that timeline, we had a huge manufacturing boom. So we have a lot of smaller industrial, we have a lot of you know, machine shops, defense contractors, aerospace. Boeing had big facilities here. Kimberly-Clark had big facilities here. And then as that ecosystem changed and we got less into manufacturing and more into distribution and whatnot, people pushed out to where the land was. And again, they went out to the Inland Empire, and where land was plentiful, distribution was the name of the game. So they started building these big warehouses. And you know, it started with, oh, hey, let's put up a 200,000 square foot building. And then they're starting to put up a million square foot buildings. And I mean, Skechers is in 1.8 million square feet. They built another one next to it. You know, the sky was kind of the limit. And now we're seeing the flip side of that. Now we're seeing more constraints put on development. City of Pomona just recently enacted legislation. You can't build a building over 25,000 square feet in the city. They don't care what your parcel size is. You're just not allowed to do that. Well, you know, explain that to Prologis, who's got acres of land there. What are we going to do with that? So, you know, I think the historical development trends play a lot into what we have today. And now, you know, kind of like you're talking about earlier with last mile and things like that, now we're kind of working backwards where we have all of this development, we have all this stuff built, and we're trying to figure out how to repurpose it and reuse it and make it fit, whether that's mall reconversions, retail reconversions, office to residential. All of those things are playing out over this huge, huge geography where, you know, realistically, I think everybody just, you know, you specialize your niche. You know, for a while, mine was the niche of, I knew the Inland Empire. I knew, you know, Corona, Ontario, all of that area on what it would be the West End. Now it's Orange County. And now my focus is Anaheim, North Orange County, which is a lot of older manufacturing, a little bit of new development, but and just kind of fulfilling that.
Looking at Orange County and your portfolio, it's different than many of the other California folks we've had on. It's predominantly, I would say, Class B industrial. Can you talk a little bit about why someone might even prefer Class B industrial as an asset class over Class A?
We have a bit of a call it unfair advantage because we've been here for so long. And we, like I said, we started in the 50s. The thing about it is you could build buildings back then and make sense out of it. As time's gone on with that land supply constraint, it's gotten harder and harder and harder to build small buildings. And I mean, I think the last 20,000 square foot or under development deal by a traditional developer here in Orange County, you're probably looking at maybe 2007, like somebody catching the tail end of it at 2008. Since then, they haven't built, like, period. It's all gone over to 100,000 square feet, 150,000 square feet, et cetera. And there's a number of factors in that. The biggest thing is entitlement. Beforehand, like with us, you'd have a small owner builder. Yeah, we'll put up 100,000 square feet this year. We'll put up 500,000, whatever, and a bunch of small buildings. Well, there's a 2-year entitlement period. So I got to tie land up now, go play with the city for 2 years before I can even put a shovel in the ground. I don't know what the market's going to be like in 2 years. And if anybody does, they're Nostradamus, because there's no way to predict, oh yeah, what's interest rates going to be 2 years from now? What's demand going to be? Whatever it is. And the bigger institutional players, they can play on those long horizons. You know, if you look at who's active in our market building, Goodman, Rexford, Prologis, I mean, these are guys with big, deep pockets, and they can weather those storms. You just don't have the small guys able to do that and really compete anymore, which creates this huge inventory supply constraint. So with them not building it and people still coming in, and yeah, people have left California, but there's still a mass of people here. It really kind of eliminates any competition. You're kind of future-proof because nobody's going to build it. Nobody's going to knock down a 200,000 square foot building and build, what, 4 or 5, 20, 30,000 square foot buildings. So from a competitive standpoint, it's great. You're kind of locked in from a supply side.
So from the demand side, let's look at tenants. So, you know, in your Class A industrial, you've got mainly corporate tenants, right? Larger corporate tenants. What does a tenant look like in a Class B industrial property? It's probably not your standard, you know, Amazon or Walmart.
Yeah. I mean, we're not seeing Amazon, Walmart, or anything along those lines. You know, I think our Class B tenants are the same, strangely enough, same as you see across the US. It's a ton of contractors, you know, HVAC, plumbing companies, roofers, anything along those lines. And honestly, for us here, partially because we've been around so long, we have a big manufacturing base still. I mean, I have a ton of machine shops. And honestly, I love machine shops as tenants because we have a guy that's in 7,000 square feet with 25 CNC machines in his shop. The cost to move that is insane. He is never going to leave. I mean, we have another tenant that's been in a building. He's been there for 25 years. and it's a 30,000 square foot building with a 20,000 square foot machine in it. You can't put that up and roll out. So, you know, we love that. Aside from that, you get kind of the quasi retail industrial uses, but honestly, we stay away from them. We just haven't had good experiences with gyms and churches and bouncy houses and anything along those lines. Yeah, and again, it plays on the massive population here.
So in terms of that massive population, what's your ultimate business strategy in your portfolio to try to utilize that best? When you're going out, are you targeting investors? Do they come to you? Are you targeting specifically certain types of tenants? How are you strategizing around your existing portfolio?
So we target tenants probably more than anything else. And we're patient when it comes to that. We'll price our stuff aggressively because we can be competitive, but we'll be picky. We want good tenants. We want people that'll be around for a while because we don't want rollover costs. And we like to build relationships. I mean, we're a small family shop. And we have 1.5 to 2 million square feet here in Southern California. And there's effectively two guys that run it. I mean, we don't have multiple players of property managers or anything else along those lines. So we don't have a big tolerance for problem tenants. We don't have the bandwidth to deal with it. And I mean, I'm sure you know, like, how much time a tenant that's behind on rent or has issues or is creating issues for other tenants, which is even worse. You know how much time that sucks up. So by being picky and making sure we get the right uses with the right operators, we're very credit sensitive. And credit sensitive for us probably is, going back to your class A, class B difference, is a little bit different. We don't care necessarily about the big corporate line. I want to know if they own a home, what their personal credit looks like, because I want somebody on the other end of the phone that I can pick up if there's a problem, talk to. And that's something that, sadly, we don't see much anymore.
Would you say most of your leases then tend to be corporate or personal guarantees? I know for us, in our portfolio, we found that a terrible credit personal guarantee is 10 times better than the best corporate guarantee. What are you guys looking at in your Class B product?
That's 1,000% right. I mean, everything we do has a personal guarantee on it. I really don't care what the company's making. And we have some rather large companies which we still have a personal guarantee, because at the end of the day, I need to be able to pick up the phone and talk to somebody if there's a problem. And when you deal with that corporate shell game, it doesn't go well. Private equity has not been my friend the last several years.
Yeah, a PE credit is typically not the best credit, at least we've found. In terms of that, what do you see on the tenant side? Because I know any tenant rep that's talking to a client is often saying, don't sign the personal guarantee. How do you play ball with that sort of a leasing game?
And this sounds horrible, but we don't. If you don't want to sign a personal guarantee, that's totally fine. There's a lot of other buildings, and somebody can lease one of them. I want to be workable, and we try to custom, and we can actually get away with customizing stuff to a really, really, really high degree. But it's really, really important to have that relationship. And if you don't, everything falls apart quickly. And honestly, you know, people talk about, oh, well, you can get in and not sign a guarantee because of the value of this or that and the other. If you look at the people that we do have personal guarantees with, I would guarantee that they have a higher net worth than virtually anybody that has ever talked to me about not signing a personal guarantee. I mean, and it's not, and it's not even close on some of them. But people understand that, I think, at a certain level of, again, it's it's a personal business. And that's just a huge piece of it. You have to have that person on the other line.
Personal guarantee is definitely a form of trust long-term that both the landlord and the tenant can have and sit there and say, look, we're in this together. And we're, and often we found it within our portfolio that when you do have that level of trust, you're willing to work with folks. We had plenty of folks that lost business during the pandemic, and we set up payment plans. We were very proud that we had, I think it was just one eviction during the entire pandemic, which for a town that's heavily reliant on logistics in Chicago, that's as well as issues like conferences and all the things that COVID absolutely killed. We're really proud of that. And I can speak volumes to that. One of the things that I'm particularly interested in, though, looking forward, and I think that you guys do uniquely well, is marketing to those Class B industrial tenants. So how do you go out and market to them? Because the corporate game for Class A is very different. It's a very different world. And I know you can speak to that later in the podcast, because that's something that you have done. But what do you think is the biggest difference between the two, and how do you go out and reach out to Class B industrial tenants?
So, you know, with most of the part around here, especially in the size range that we're talking about, let's call it 5 to 20,000 square foot buildings. A lot of those guys are going to have existing real estate relationships. And for us, I market to other brokers. That is easily my number one source of deals. We treat other brokers in, I think, really, really well. You know, I'm super free with information. If we have something coming up, any of the guys around here know they can pick up the phone and call me, even if we don't have it listed. And I'll go out 6 months with them and go, okay, yeah, we have this maybe, or maybe this, or what have you got? Or, and we'll, and again, with us, we can get creative on structuring timing or this, that, or the other. And it's trust. You know, I think we've worked a long time to build a relationship where people know whatever we say, we're going to do. And it's hard to kind of convey that to maybe the market in mass. But in developing that with the other brokers in the area, it makes a big difference. And we pay super, super fast. Typically, if somebody gives me a lease, I will give them a check on the spot.
We have found that within our portfolio as well. Is so about half my business is doing tenant rep, and about half my business is doing landlord side. I'm one of those really rare oddballs in the business that does both. And look, I really care about my tenants, and I don't necessarily care a lot about if I get paid in a month or two, because I've done well enough on my landlord side. But that's not the way a lot of brokers behave. You know, that next check is everything to them. And so we found within our own portfolio that by paying that same day the lease is signed, and you have brokers beating down your door to try to get deals done. Yeah. And I can only imagine it's very similar in California. So in terms of going along with that, I'm curious, because you've done both, you know, Class A industrial and Class B industrial. What do you think are the biggest differences between the two asset classes in terms of your role as a landlord broker and kind of how the asset classes behave?
So it's funny, it goes back to that personal, and that's probably honestly why I do what I do now. It goes back to that personal side of things. With Class B, I'm probably talking to the guy that owns the business. If he makes an extra $5,000 a month, it goes into his pocket, his kids' college fund, or whatever the heck else it is. So, you know, it's a different level of care and concern versus if you're dealing on the corporate side, your number's on a spreadsheet. And whatever the spreadsheet says at the higher up level of corporate or at the higher up level of development or whatever it is, that's what we work off of. And it takes a little bit of that personal side out of it. And I think it creates other issues. I mean, if you came to me tomorrow and said, hey, I want to lease a space from you, we could probably get it done and I could get you keys next Friday. Not this Friday, but next Friday. Give me a week and a half, right? Because realistically, it's like, okay, let's come to some reasonable terms. Here's our lease document. Our lease document's super fair. All right, cool. We'll call it a day. On the corporate side, if you've come to me, that means your boss has told you that you need to go find space, which means their boss has probably told them that they need to go find space. And maybe there's some board of directors that said that they need to go find space too. So when they find it, then they've got to report up, down, up that chain, down that chain. And, you know, it's their job. So they want to make it look good. So we're going to fluff it up and we're going to do that. And so now we've taken a month of paperwork back and forth, and we haven't even gotten to the attorneys yet. Because now I've got corporate counsel on the other end, and those guys get paid by the hour. So I don't care what lease you send them, they're going to come back with some level of comments. And now I've got to go work through that with our attorney. And now it's that same lease is effectively a 2 to 3 month process with a whole bunch of wait and see. And it's just a very different feeling. And honestly, at the end of the day, you probably got less than the guy that came to me and said, hey, let's knock this out and we got it done in a week.
So in terms of trying to reduce costs, I'm curious, we've talked to other industrial portfolios on the podcast in terms of how they reduce costs for transitioning a space between tenants. And do you go about it with full personalization and customization, or are you somebody who creates kind of standardized spaces, standardized paint, standardized carpet? How do you go about a transition of a space?
Your timing is perfect because there's like so normally we have like a general standard. And look, we're long-term hold. I mean, we're talking about buildings that are 50, 60 years old now. We put a ton of money into our real estate to maintain it and to maintain it at a high level so I have Class B product, but I can compete against the new building all day long because all our buildings have LVT flooring and LED lighting and all of the other adjectives and, you know, three-letter abbreviations on all of the other systems. But it goes back to that personal touch. So we leased a space. I was with my property manager this morning and met with the tenant, walked him in, showed him, okay, this is where we're doing carpet and paint and this, that, and the other. The tenant said, no, I don't need the flooring, just do carpet. That's fine. That's great. And then we get into the warehouse and it's a smaller building, 6,000 square feet. And he says, you know, I know you're painting in here and I really would like to have red walls. Can you paint it red for me? Now, that sounds like, oh yeah, it's just a different color, right? Well, there's all kinds of fun stuff that you learn. First off, red is a very light base paint, which means you have to put like 3-4 coats of it down and prime the crap out of it before to get it to stick to look anything at all decent. And second off, when you're covering it up, oh yeah, it's paint. And we're talking about not a huge warehouse, but it's, you know, 18 foot clear, 6,000 feet. So it's a decent amount of coverage. But we call our painter. We got a change order on it. We talked to the tenant. He said, yeah, I'll cover it. We'll cover half. Boom, boom, boom. And he's going to have red walls in a week and a half. So we can do that, but that's because we're, you know, nimble enough to do it and kind of very, you know, depending on the circumstance. And, you know, it's a 5-year lease. We kind of rationalize it on other ways on how we're going to cover that later. But, and I think that's part of what separates us is we can do a little bit of that customization, but as a general rule, yeah, it's going to be standardized.
In terms of standardized real estate, there's no standard investment procedure, no standard taxes, nothing. And we have folks that are in California and folks that are in New Jersey and folks that are in Miami and, you know, we're Chicago, Illinois, Wisconsin, the tri-state area. In terms of looking at portfolios, one of the things I think that makes California the most unique is that it's a very difficult market to get into. And so I'm curious, how did your investors amass the portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different things there. I mean, as far as how we got in, the best way possible, we started a long time ago, because time's your enemy, especially out here. So, you know, everything that we own, we built, and we built from 55 to 75. And it was a transition from a home build, or the gentleman that founded the company, Mr. Hoyt, transitioned from home building into industrial. And again, to give you an idea of the way things were, the park that we're at here, most of the buildings are about 7,000 square feet. And he would have a tenant come up and they needed a space and he didn't have a 7,000 square foot building. He'd say, okay, that's no problem. Come back in 30 days. And 30 days later, there'd be a 7,000 square foot building up there for them to occupy. That's not going to happen right now. You'd be lucky to get, like, heck, you'd be lucky to get into City Hall in 30 days, much less get anything else done. So having that history and having that ability to grow in such a climate that was so business friendly, which I think is a lot of the draw for some of these other cities. Like, you know, you hear stories of Texas and Florida and all those other areas. That helped a ton. Now, as far as getting into the market, I mean, there's a number of things. I mean, the first off is price. You know, I look at deals all across the country, and you know, if you want to go buy a 10,000 square foot building here in California, it's $4 million all day long. It's $400 a square foot. And that's not an insignificant number. Oh, and by the way, if you're an investor and you're buying it, well, you're buying it at a maybe five and a half cap right now, which, you know, obviously interest rates fluctuate over the years, but basically whatever the cap rate is in your market, just go ahead and divide it in half. And that's what it is in California. And then after you've gone through all of that loveliness, then you get to deal with the regulations and all the other things where you get your ADA lawsuits that you have to defend out here, or you just write them a check. You get your permit violations, you get your business licenses, you get the whole other litany of things put against you. So it makes it incredibly difficult, but where it pays off is 20 years later or 30 years later. And the number of clients that I've had over the years, back when I was at Lee or even with us, I mean, they're not making any more of it. And barring total financial collapse, the prices aren't going to go down. They can't.
Yeah, it's a constrained supply. So in terms of that, we're getting kind of to the end of the podcast, and we have a constrained supply on time. And so I was curious if you'd be willing to answer our final four questions. They're always a great last little bit and a way to get to know you a little bit better and to get to know a little bit better where the future of the real estate industry is going. So the first question, and one of my favorites, is where do you see commercial real estate going 10 years out?
You know, this kind of goes back to the changes in California. I think you're going to see more and more hybridization. We're seeing repurposing of retail into more fulfillment, more last mile type facilities. We're seeing office into residential. We're seeing residential density gets pushed up around here. We're seeing malls getting converted to residential. And I don't think we're going to become Houston necessarily, where we have no zoning and it's Wild West. But I think you're going to continue to see, over a long term, this continued push to have more than one type of building or service or whatever it may be kind of mashed together.
Are you starting to see that in practice in California yet? Because I know there's a couple communities that I've sat on planning commissions, and or I wouldn't say planning commissions, but like sat on planning boards that are associated with looking for long-term strategic plans of their communities. And increasingly we're starting to see this model, but I haven't seen it deployed yet. So I was curious, have you started to see this deployed in California? And if so, where?
So I've seen it on, you know, you're starting to see it on case by case basis. So the mall thing is here. That's definitely here. I mean, there's the mall in City of Orange. That's residential now. Got the mall in Laguna Hills. That's residential now. You've got the mall in Santa Ana. That's residential now. Big residential components going on to it. Totally revitalizing what was there, totally changing it up. So you're already seeing that kind of residential retail blend. And I think those fit well. What we're seeing now out here is the retail industrial blend, where there's been a couple big box stores. I'll use Best Buy as an example, where they put up a wall in the middle of the store, and the second half of it is last mile fulfillment. Yeah, you can come and pick it up, or they'll go deliver it to you. So you're starting to see that. Obviously, office to residential is talked about, but I don't know where that's going to come out. That's a big hurdle. But if you ask something, you know, long term, I think that's a trend that we're going to continue to see, just as people try to figure out what to do with some of the spaces, shopping habits change, and just consumer behavior changes and everything else.
Office to residential conversion is difficult. We have a couple folks that are coming on the podcast recently, or not recently, coming on the podcast soon, that are going to talk about that, including, I think, one from California. We're going to see if we're going to land him, which would be interesting.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things that we like to do is take a step back as well. So I know you started off working at Lee Class A Industrial, and even previously started off doing residential. I'm curious, if you go back to the start of your career, what advice would you give?
So I started in 2007, like the summer of 2007, and basically worked that market from like the middle of 2007 to like, let's call it 2010, 2011. And it was rough. It was really, really rough. And I think that kind of got me in the habit of, as most brokers do, just focusing on the next deal. Current deal is great. It's done. Now I got to find the next one. And in doing that, I've never really taken the time over until recently to celebrate the wins when they do come along, especially when it's hard going. And I think I could have done a better job of doing that. I remember it was another developer was at a dinner, and he made the comment that when he was a broker, he always took a little piece of his commission, whatever it was, even if it was $100 commission, whatever it was, and bought himself something with it. Lighter, a Ferrari, whatever it was, just to kind of remember, like, hey, why are we doing this? This is fun. It can be a slog, but it is fun at the end of the day. And especially in the hard times, I think that's probably the best thing to remember, and could celebrate those wins a little bit more.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. I know for us, we've been through some good times and some bad times in the brokerage world. And so often we don't sit back and smell the roses, because there's often so much good out there. One of the good things that we do try to find out there, though, that's not just purely monetary, is knowledge. And the podcast is all about reaching out to find interesting voices. But one of the things we find is some of those interesting voices have interesting books and interesting book suggestions. So I'm curious, is there a book that you think that every young broker or real estate professional or developer or investor should be reading?
So the book, and it got passed around out here in California probably more than elsewhere. It's an older book, so you got to hunt for it. It's called Alpha Dog, The Battle of Commerce. And okay. Have you heard of it by any chance?
No, I have not, no.
So it was written by the former managing director of what would have been the CB office in Commerce. It is allegedly a fiction book, allegedly. But anybody around here that was active between, call it 80 and 2000, can probably guess where some of the inspiration came from. And it's an interesting take and an interesting insight into some of the behind the scenes glamorous, not so glamorous stuff in the commercial real estate world. So as a young guy, we tell everybody to read it because it's a good read.
So I know we're getting towards the end of the podcast, but we have one final question that we always like to ask, and it's the whole reason for the podcast. And it's just simply, we find that the men and women that are in the arena know who to reach out to and have more insight into the industry than anybody else. So if we're to reach out to somebody to have on the podcast next, who should it be?
For more info on Class B industrial, there's a local developer here in Southern California. His name's Rob Guthrie at Guthrie Development. And he's got a slightly different take on the Class B industrial. He is more into the condo conversion process, which with the constraints that we have around here makes a lot of sense, but it's a very different deal than your traditional buy and hold real estate. And he's been around for a while. He's a great guy.
So we do have one last question to ask before we end. And it's simply, what's the best way that somebody who's listening to the podcast today can get in touch with you?
I mean, you can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, but I mean, honestly, pick up the phone and call me. Brian Industrial Properties in Southern California. Happy to chat anytime. And I think that's honestly the best way to do it is actually just sit down and talk to somebody and, you know, break bread.
Thanks again to Matt for coming on the podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a share, a follow, and especially a review. Reviews and listener metrics truly matter, and they help us continue to get quality guests. You can follow us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, and wherever, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.